And the time is 10 a.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, climate change on People Rise Up. Programs made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. More information is available at 503-239-4991. Or theportlandalliance.org. And the new issue is out, so you can find yours around town. Morning. You're listening to KBOO. This is People Rise Up. My name is Andrew Geller, and it's very nice to be back in front of the board here sitting in this chair, although I prefer a different chair, after a what I'd like to think of as a well-deserved, not long enough break. Not from radio, but just from everything. Spent most of the past 6 weeks in both the southern and eastern hemisphere in New Zealand, and it was great. Anyone that wants to talk to me more about New Zealand can send me an email from the KBOO website. So this is actually my first show since the fall pledge drive, which to many of you probably seems like a distant memory, having listened to KBOO for the past several weeks. Thanks a whole lot to everyone who pledged during the People Rise Up specials. We did extraordinarily well, and all guests were very pleased to hear that you folks supported the station and the program when they were on. So again, thanks for that. Pay your pledge if you haven't. And now to what we're doing today. One of the things I heard most about traveling as a U.S. citizen overseas was regarding climate change and people driving and energy use, etc., etc. And why isn't the United States playing along with the rest of the world as the biggest problem in this? And I did what I could to answer those questions and thought it was time to do some more climate radio and get a jump on my typical, I guess, January cycle related to climate. So this morning, we're going to be talking about policy side of issues and a little bit of the science. We'll hopefully have someone I really want to speak with on the air talking about the science next week, and we'll just see about that. But this morning, I have on the line Joellen Perry. She is the manager of the Climate Change and Energy Program at the International Institute for Sustainable Development. And if I'm correct, you're in Winnipeg, right?
Yes, we are.
Right. Okay. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Morning.
Morning. And I'm not quite sure why, but I have a strange little echo in my ears. And as you keep talking, I'll try and figure that out. Now, we are about 10 years out from the adoption of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is kind of the broad context under which the Kyoto Protocol was adopted in 1997. Can you give us a minute or two of history about how the two of those things happened, and then we can kind of leap forward from the adoption of Kyoto?
Okay. The issue of climate change really became a hot one more towards the end of the 1980s. And at that time, the international community agreed that they needed to examine it in greater detail. And they formed the International Panel on Climate Change in 1988. And out of the work of that panel, there came a greater understanding of how climate is changing and its potential ramifications for society that led to the convention itself. The UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, was signed as part of the Rio Convention in 1992. And it sets out sort of the objectives for the international community on how it's going to go about climate change. However, it only included voluntary targets or voluntary commitments to reducing climate change. So there was growing pressure as the science came out to say that we need to have something more than just voluntary commitments. We need to have binding commitments. And that's what led to the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. And since that time, there's been a lot of debate in the international community on the details behind the protocol, and now we're looking at its actual implementation or its entry into force this February with the ratification of the protocol by Russia.
Right, and for people who didn't know that, Russia ratified it, I guess it was just before I actually left, sometime in the past 6 or 8 weeks.
It's November the 5th.
Oh, okay, it was
big
even more
day
reason.
In the policy community. So.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay, now, so Kyoto was signed. It took 7 years to get enough countries involved, not so much in absolute numbers. I guess there were 55 needed, but it was the percentage of greenhouse gas, human-created greenhouse gas emissions, that was the sticking point, because the U.S. with at least 25% wouldn't play and actually pulled out in 2001, just after George Bush took office. The media this week, and the reason in part that we're talking about this is the 10th session of the Conference of Parties, hereafter referred to as COP10, begins in just under a week down in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and goes from the 6th to the 17th with kind of the high-level policy stuff thought to take place the last 3 days. Now, as a lead up to this, and also leading into Britain becoming, I've seen too many European government names. They're becoming the head of the, it's the G8 they're taking over.
Right.
Tony Blair says he wants to focus on climate change, but at the same time, he also was talking earlier this week, quoted in British press, saying that the international community must find, quote, a different way forward to tackle climate change because the U.S. will not change its mind regarding the Kyoto Protocol. So at the one hand, he's saying, you know, it needs to be really active, focal issue. But because the U.S. doesn't want to do what all these other countries want to, all the other countries need to figure out a different way. Is there any chance that that actually is going to occur?
I would say that, yes, that is a possibility. Right now, under the Kyoto Protocol, we have a system in which all countries globally are to agree to one particular process for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It creates an umbrella agreement under which all countries act. What is a possibility is that in looking beyond Kyoto, beyond 2012, when the first commitment underneath the Kyoto Protocol ends, we could be looking at a wide variety of different systems, one of which could be a regional approach. Right now, for example, the European Union has its European Emissions Trading System in place. And that system encompasses all countries that fall underneath the European Union, including the new accession countries like Poland and Latvia. So the European Union could set for itself its own emission reduction target and its own process by which it's going to go about reaching that target. Similarly, a parallel could be drawn for a North American and or a North American and South American approach for reducing climate change, in which there would be sort of a continental target set, and we would be able to figure out within North and South America how it is that we are going to go about reaching our particular target. That might be one way of engaging the U.S. in making more binding or more stringent targets for reaching its emission reductions.
Yeah, unfortunately, the U.S. doesn't have much in the way of a positive track record regarding international binding treaties, especially in the last 3 to 4 years, but it is a longer trend, dating back to probably the first treaty signed with native peoples of this continent.
However, it's important to recognize the fact that within the United States, internationally and at the federal level, there hasn't been very much progressive action on climate change. But at the state level, there is a number of positive indicators of taking climate change seriously and setting targets and standards for greenhouse gas emission reductions.
Well, and possibly most recently in Colorado, people voted in a renewable energy, basically a mandate regarding the electricity supply portfolio there, which is really great.
Mm-hmm.
But the Framework Convention on Climate Change, under which Kyoto was negotiated, had as its goal, and again, here's an example of, you know, great language, great goal, but what does actually happen? The Framework Convention's goal was to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Now, even before Kyoto is being implemented, and again, I know that you're not a scientist, you're working on the policy side, but there's a lot of science that's come out in the past year or two that says, to an extent, it's already too late for that. There is a new report earlier this month, or I guess now technically last month, early November, from the Pew Center on Climate that is produced by a very well-respected climate scientist, Camille Parmesan, who a year or so back put a study out regarding the shift in timings of flowering and mating, as well as geographic region of many plants and animals. You know, so there are observable, possibly very significant effects that we're just seeing the beginning of happening. So, I mean, the IPCC, the UN science body that basically provided the science background for what the policy folks at Kyoto worked out, have called for a 60 to 80% reduction, and Kyoto's looking at 5, and that's even difficult to get. Not that I don't think international cooperation is a good idea, but is this, I mean, are we seeing anything that's even close to being able to deal with the biology that's taking place in the real world, not subject to kind of, you know, policy whims?
Well, the Kyoto Protocol is a first and very small step towards the longer-term greenhouse gas reductions that are going to be needed, be it 60% or 80%. But it's a really important first step because it involves a change in mindset and a change in our understanding of how it is that we go about using energy primarily and taking account of greenhouse gas emissions. Right now we have a continual human history trend of rising release of greenhouse gas emissions, and making that turn and making that change is the key step. Once we get onto that path, moving in a different direction, it's going to be, I would think, an accelerated process. So you'll see that once you make those first small steps and begin to see that it's possible to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, it's economically feasible to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, that there will be just sort of an accelerated process of moving along that path towards the longer-term greenhouse gas goals that the global community has set.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO. My guest today is Joellen Perry. She is the manager of the Climate Change and Energy Program at the International Institute for Sustainable Development up in Winnipeg, Manitoba. You can find out more about their organization online at www.iisd.ca, and it's a very well-organized site that is huge. Just the climate change stuff is huge, and that's one of, I guess, a dozen or 15 broad areas you folks deal with, as well as a lot of great media-related feeds. You can also find more information about the show at the KBOO website, kboo.fm. Go to the program schedule and click on People Rise Up Wednesday morning at 10, and there'll be links to a whole lot of information about what we're talking about today, which is the policy side of dealing with the climate change issue globally. Now, the Kyoto Protocol, of course, is a first step, and pretty much everyone outside the U.S. anyway understands that, the U.S. not even quite viewing it as a first step. So post-2012, I see more media saying chances are not so great to actually get anything significant post-2012 in terms of a discussion out of this meeting. They think it'll probably happen in 2006, possibly a little more next year, but it's really a couple, 3 years away. Do you feel as though there's a chance that post-2012 there will be realization either through things we observe in the natural world, or shifts in maybe governments in significant countries, that people will start talking about the types of shifts in terms of reducing greenhouse gases that, you know, will the policy catch up with the science, do you think? Or do you think they'll keep talking, you know, instead of 5%, they'll say, well, let's do 10% and double our goal, which sounds impressive, but it's still only 10%.
That's a very difficult question to answer, because I think that there's already some clear indications of the climatic changes that are ongoing as a result of global warming. In Canada, for example, we can see firsthand the changes that are taking place in the Arctic. The First Nation people in Canada's Arctic are seeing fundamental changes in sea ice patterns, wildlife habitat, birds, flowers, permafrost melt. It's having a tremendous impact today on their way of life, and has a very serious long-term consequences for their traditional beliefs and their traditional practices and their sustainable development over time. Yet, as much as we can communicate that to Canadian audiences, it still remains a bit intangible, and still it's hard to believe that climate change is going to have a real and permanent impact on you today, mm-hmm. Which it makes it more difficult to stimulate action. I think that over time, it is, as people see an increase in the number of hurricanes that are happening in or that are affecting Florida, for example.
Or hurricanes where they never had them before, as in the case of Brazil.
Exactly. I think that over time there's going to be growing concern about those impacts within North America, and that's where real action needs to take place. On the other hand, the other area where there's deep concern about the impacts of climate change already is in small island states and in developing countries. Many developing countries feel that the droughts that they are experiencing right now are abnormal, and that they are a result of climate change. And they want to see action happen on emission reductions.
In fact, leaders of some of the small Pacific Island nations talk in the context of genocide as what's happening to their countries, and they're very serious and consider each person that doesn't act to, you know, mitigate their own input to the climate issue is culpable.
Right, and those statements are also coming out of the Inuit in northern Canada,
mm-hmm.
that they're looking not necessarily at genocide in the terms of death of people, but definitely at cultural genocide, because the traditional knowledge that they have built their lives around is no longer going to be relevant, because it's also connected with the way the land works and the diseases, etc.
I haven't actually checked this for this program, but I don't think that the international definition of genocide necessarily involves death. It can be cultural, and it can be a relocation kind of issue, forced relocation. Saw an interesting article about how the Inuit are having cultural problems in the context of not understanding animals and plants that they see. There's no word in their mm-hmm. language because they've never seen certain animals and plants before that are showing up regularly. So like the robin that many of us know, to them, they don't have the name robin for this bird. So it's the bird with the red chest kind of a thing. And so anyway, you can read all about that article if you pull up, do a search on the news for Inuit climate change language. A couple of things that the Kyoto Protocol, when it's implemented February 16th, will, I guess, both finalize and introduce in a way are carbon markets and the clean development mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Now, carbon markets are going to be very similar, I imagine, to the other types of emission trading markets that have been developed around the world. Is that more accurate than not?
Yes. In fact, actually, the model for the creation of the Kyoto market mechanisms is the emissions trading system for sulfur dioxide in northeastern United States.
Okay. In general, what's your assessment of emission trading markets in terms of their both success in achieving significant reductions and can they do it in a timely manner? Are they really effective?
I would say yes. At this point in time, they are effective. Of course, we won't really know until we see perhaps progress with the European emissions trading system, which is going to come online in 2005. However, what we have seen so far is that there is increasingly being put a price on carbon, and that process is bringing carbon into the market and stimulating industries to take action to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, be that as part of a emissions trading system, but also just in terms of investor pressure on companies who are saying, shareholders saying, what are you doing to address climate change? And are you actually making this particular company liable for action in the future for having not reduced your greenhouse gas emissions?
Now, a common argument regarding emissions trading is that, as years pass, total allowable emissions are reduced, but because of the trading aspect of it, in a way, certain specific areas can remain fairly polluted, at least in the short term, because it will dissipate as air is fluid.
Mm-hmm.
But with carbon, it's sort of a different issue than I imagine nitrates and sulfur dioxide, because it really does have a significant global impact no matter where it's emitted.
Right, and that's why the emission trading systems that have been established underneath the Kyoto Protocol allow emissions trading between countries. and encourage, for example, under the Clean Development Mechanism, investment by industrialized countries in developing countries to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, which not only helps the industrialized country, government, or industry to meet their domestically set targets, but also helps the developing country to move towards a more climate-friendly form of development, which is incredibly important when you consider that China, for example, has the second highest greenhouse gas emissions in the world, right behind the United States. And those emissions are just going to grow over time due to population growth and simply because of the industrialization of that country.
Now, we just got a couple minutes left here, and I'm curious what resources you might suggest to listeners who want to stay more than just casually informed when the mainstream media decides to report on anything related to climate change. Where would be some good web locations for folks to go look at aside from IISD.ca?
Well, actually, I think the one you want is actually IISD.org.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But that's okay. I was going to, it depends upon what type of information that you are looking for, and I'm afraid I am going to promote one of IISD's products, which is something called the Earth Negotiations Bulletin, which is, if you go to IISD.ca, that's actually where you will end up. And the Earth Negotiation Bulletin is sort of a separate within our institute as a whole, and it provides neutral coverage of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change process as well as the negotiations themselves. So it is the sort of premier location for information about what's going on within the convention. Otherwise, if you're looking outside of that, you mentioned one of the premier resources, which is the Pew Center in the United States. Has all sorts of very good and very useful sources of information about climate change, the international process, and what's going on within the United States.
And I'll just I'll second that about the Earth Negotiations Bulletin. I've actually got the November 13th issue here in front of me, which is all about the 22nd IPCC meeting in Delhi about 3.5 weeks ago. Again, www.iisd.ca, and the November 13th issue is volume 12, number 248, for folks that want to check more out about that. Remember, the IPCC is different than the Kyoto Protocol, which is what we've been talking about. And I'll just throw one more site up, www.climatearc.org. And that's ARK, and it's a tremendously large portal site with pretty much access to everything related to climate change, even the dwindling skeptics regarding it. So go check them out as well.
Yeah, and if you want to look at, or if you're curious about what it is that industry and business is doing, I would recommend going to the Climate Group website, which is a UK-based NGO that is working to highlight some of the success stories of large corporations in reducing their emissions. As much as I'm not a big fan of large corporations, some of them are taking very progressive action, and if we want to see long-term change take place, it's those type of progressive actors that need to be supported.
Thank you very much for being on the program this morning, Joellen.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye.
My guest has been Joellen Perry. She's the manager of the Climate Change and Energy Program at the International Institute for Sustainable Development. You can find out more about them online again at www.iisd.org. And I think I'm going to be continuing with climate change next week. Again, not 100% sure, but I will have climate change as a regular thing in the next couple of months because, again, it's a really important thing. Keep your thermostat down just a little bit more if you can. If you heat with fossil fuels, maybe don't drive quite as much. There's real simple things that everybody can do little bit at a time The Bike Show says, ride your bike. I'm an all-weather cyclist. You could be too. It's honestly not as hard as you might think.